Select your program.
Dialogue.
Program initiated.
Approach the threshold. Engage rationality. Open your mind. Godspeed.
Propelling past nebulas and stars to your listening devices, this is Flagship Freedom, the podcast that places you on the front line in the war of ideas. My name is Michael.
It's Danny Boy.
Welcome back, Danny Boy.
Thank you.
This is a pleasure to have you back. I did miss you, and I know that the listeners did too, but you were there in spirit, and I assume that you listened to the previous couple episodes, right?
Of course. Well, just seeing and hearing all of the amazing ways that the free market can circumvent even a clear and present existing violent monopoly, it just opens up millions of doors as to how we could solve all of the complex problems in society. Like, you and I sit here and pontificate about how would we have roads, how would we have security. This guy's been there, done that, and hasn't lost an officer in how many years. It's really fascinating and wonderful to hear a real-life story, especially in our own backyard over here in Michigan. So awesome episodes.
Yeah, I thought that the stuff that he was giving us was remarkable. And when we released it, much to my amazement, everyone else seemed to be embracing with open arms and open ears. I think that I got quite a bit of people asking a lot more questions afterwards, both on our page and on other pages that I was posting to. People were really fascinated with the idea and the fact that there's actually a model that exists that works. It's not just that it's there and it's doing okay, but there's a model that is even more successful in many ways than the police. So today we have another conversation, which is going in a little different direction from the previous one. We are being joined by the Asian capitalist. His name is Jeff Tay, and Jeff runs a blog, which we will post in the show notes below, as usual, and he is also a personal friend of mine. We had a conversation that started really with a background of his transformation into becoming a libertarian and an anarcho-capitalist, and talked a little bit about his background in regards to immigration, which is a hot topic now and is an important topic with all three of us. And we got into the nitty-gritty of why we should have open borders rather than closed borders. And it's something that I've been thinking about a lot since our conversation. And I still have a lot of kinks to work out in my thinking of closed and open border immigration, because there's a lot of very famous anarcho-capitalists that think contrary to our opinion, and that have some very valid and important issues that we have to contend with. And Jeff brought some of those up, and I hope that you guys enjoy this conversation. Danny, what do you think about it?
Well, there's been a lot of internal fighting and debate within the liberty community lately.
Yeah.
And we saw some of that. And really, it boils down to philosophy versus pragmatism in the moment, you know, given the current situation. And there are important questions to answer. I'd like to fall down on the principled side. I think it works out even with the state, even contending against the current status quo. But, you know, fair criticisms, you know, we don't want to be accused of being purists. No matter what, we do have to apply our ideas to real life. They can't just be, you know, so heavenly good that we're so heavenly minded that we're no earthly good. But in any case, good conversation, and look forward to more with Jeff.
Yeah, so do I. So, dear listeners, here it goes.
All right, listeners, we have on the program the Asian capitalist himself, after such a long time of trying to set this thing up, Jeff Tay himself. Jeff, welcome to the Flagship Freedom.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, you are very, very welcome. You've communicated with us a lot on our Facebook. And
doing a bit of trolling.
Doing a little bit of trolling. That's true, and we appreciate that sort of stuff. You know, you can't really have a following without a couple of trolls, and we are welcoming your trolling on our Facebook. Jeff and I met at the Tales and Nexus, which is a filmmaker conference of sort over in California. I believe it's
Screenwriting Workshop.
Right, Screenwriting Workshop. And Jeff and I hit it off very well and talked about a lot of things over a very short period of time. And I learned that Jeff blogs and...
I also YouTube, but not a lot of people know that.
Oh, well, yeah, I didn't know that either. And we'll certainly share that with our listeners too. But
work in progress.
Work in progress. Yeah, I think we all are works in progress. Okay. Yeah. So Jeff has been a regular listener as well, and he's had a lot to contribute on the social media. And this is really giving ourselves a forum so we can talk out a lot of the conversations that we've had piecemeal in the public sphere. I think that you are probably up to date on a couple of the more controversial episodes that we've had. Some of the SJW one, an alt-right episode. We were dissecting the cultures of both of those. You had a lot to say about those sorts of things, and particularly one of the big topics that I want to talk about right now, before I actually want you to introduce yourself a little bit and give a background as to where you come from, but I want to get into immigration first and foremost. And I know that you have a very strong connection to immigration and immigrants, seeing as though I believe you are a first-generation immigrant.
So first generation would be... No, actually, I'm second generation then, because my parents would be the first generation, right?
Danny and I have talked about that a lot, where we're not sure whether the immigrant themselves is the immigrant or whether they're the first generation.
First generation born in North.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So we'll have to figure that out one way or another. We've talked about that quite a bit, but we don't have an answer. But anyway, so you were born in Canada?
I was born in Canada, yes.
Okay, got it. But you still have a very strong connection to immigrants, and you have a strong connection to where your parents came from.
Right, because I actually, even though I was born in Canada, I actually did move back to Malaysia for about 4 years during my early childhood, or late childhood, actually, from age 9 to 13.
Got Whereabouts in Malaysia are you from? Are your parents?
KL, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so give us a background on your upbringing, maybe your philosophical and political, I guess, intellectual career.
Right, okay.
And then where you are right now.
Well, I got to say, it's been a very long and winding journey towards anarcho-capitalism, right? You know, nobody's born an ANCAP, or maybe we're born ANCAPs, but we quickly lose it and become something else, right? So yeah, it's the road back towards being an ANCAP, took about, I remember actually 4 years ago, in the last election cycle, I was still cheering for Obama to beat Romney. So I was still a liberal 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's only been in the last about three-ish years that I became a libertarian. Right now, I would say that even though I do believe that anarcho-capitalism is the most philosophically consistent political philosophy, I still have some reservations about whether or not it'll work as smoothly as we think it'll work, right?
Mm, okay.
Yeah. So right now, I would say that I'm kind of an advocate for minarchism first.
Okay.
And then from minarchism, let's slowly take away powers from the state until we can't take away anymore, right?
Were you always very involved in politics? Were you very outspoken advocate, let's say, for progressivism or liberalism, or did you always consider yourself a liberal, when you started to consider yourself anything at all?
Yeah, well, I think that I've always kind of had that in me. I remember there's a few very key moments in my life where I kind of, some people would say it's the red pill, right? In the ninth grade, actually, for my English class, I read the book 1984.
Yeah.
Which was, I don't know how many school curriculums it's still on, right? But at that time when I read that book and when we were discussing it in class, I think my teacher was a closet libertarian, actually, because he would talk about mistrusting the government and about central planning and all the failures that it is historically caused, right?
Yeah.
And I think that was I was about 15 years old, and that was when I first really, really started getting interested in how society organizes itself. And then at the same time, the movie The Matrix came out, And that was like another big moment for me. And ever since then, I've been really interested in how different societies organize themselves, right? And that slowly brought me towards libertarianism.
If I may ask, what topics would you say made you a liberal? Because, you know, as you know, libertarianism shares, you could say, some liberal tendencies on the social side of things, but right. not really economically speaking. So, and I'm right. always very shocked and amazed and interested in people who come from the liberal tradition economically, because those people uh-huh. are like almost impossible to change their mind. So yeah, what made you liberal?
So I think I wouldn't say most, a lot of liberals are well-intentioned, right? And I think a lot of people generally just want to see other people be happy, right? So I think there's a lot of that in modern day progressivism, where they think they know how to make the most people happy, right? And they base their policies and ideas on that idea, on that premise. And I think I had that too. And ultimately I think what attracted me about libertarianism was that it kind of has this, like, to each their own. And what could make the most more people happy than to each their own, each person getting to dictate how they want to live their life, as long as they don't infringe upon the freedoms of others, right? Yeah, so that's kind of where the shift happened.
Did your parents at all influence your politics in the least, especially, you know, being immigrants themselves? And I'm not exactly sure their occupations now, but, you know, obviously they left Malaysia to come to Canada to seek yeah. perhaps something that more valued their labor, or perhaps just basically greener pastures and yeah. better opportunities. So I'm curious if you're okay with talking about perhaps their politics, whether it influenced them, and sure. maybe your family history.
Well, I can tell you that libertarianism and this idea of liberty barely exists in Asian culture. I mean, I would bet that the majority of people who live in Asia don't know what a libertarian is, right? However, capitalism and the love of capitalism actually is an idea, especially in Chinese culture. I mean, my parents, well, my grandfather on my dad's side was a businessman, and all of his children ended up becoming businessmen. So there's definitely a love of capitalism that runs in my family. And I think in a lot of Chinese families, actually.
There certainly is a growing, I would say, the westernization of certain parts of the East. Let's say, mm-hmm. of course, Japan, which resists right. some aspects of the westernization. They love a lot of Western culture, but mm-hmm. they are still, to a certain extent, they have some central planning aspects, and they're very, very traditional, especially when it comes to gender roles. Yeah. And egalitarianism isn't quite their line of reasoning. And then, of course, in Hong Kong and in Singapore, I would say those are capitalist bastions as far as it can be in the East. So you've got these situations where capitalism, aka the voluntary trading of goods and services, is almost thought of as, it's part and parcel of what it means to be westernized. But they don't really take that into consideration when they're thinking about social aspects. There's like a right. disconnect between the social and the economic.
Especially in Singapore, where it's very, very authoritarian in terms of what you can do. You can't even chew gum. If you litter, you could get... I mean, there was a case when I was growing up of an American who was studying in Singapore, and he vandalized some street signs. And he ended up getting caned 100 or 200 times in the butt. So it was, yeah.
Yeah, Singapore's not as free as people think. I was there a year or so ago, and I was shocked to find it. They actually call it the nanny state over there. And you're not allowed to own a car for more than 10 years.
Really?
Yeah, because they want the place to look pretty. So in some ways it's free, but in others it's not at all. Yeah, you can't chew gum because they don't
because
want you to
rude?
Spit gum on this.
No, because it'll damage
just
public property. Yeah.
Ah, fascinating. I haven't heard of
it. So the leader of Singapore has actually been the leader of Singapore for decades. And he's kind of this, he's a utopian, I guess you could say. So he's trying to monitor every little detail of his perfect little society, right?
We had a discussion, perhaps, it was 3 or 4 weeks ago when we were releasing the alt-right analysis about immigration. And I know, yeah, obviously that's a topic of that you have concern about. I have concern about too, not only because my grandparents were immigrants and I have many immigrant friends myself. I have vested interest in the economics of the society as well as the morality of our system, mm-hmm, of governance. So we chatted about this, and immigration seems to be a very hot button issue with the alt-right.
I would say it's been the issue of 2016. Yeah. I mean, if you look at what Brexit was largely about for a lot of people, and if you look at what Trump was about for a lot of people, you know, immigration was kind of the topic.
It was, and it is no less a heated issue in libertarian circles.
Even in
ANCAP circles, who are the most diehard, liberty-loving sorts of folks. it seems to be a matter of contention even within that. When they are the most pure, they are the most laissez-faire individuals that exist philosophically, they still tend to fall into the trappings of the alt-right, uh-huh, and perhaps nationalism and closed borders and things like this. We had recently Walter Block on, and I brought this topic up with him, and he ran through a small dosing of his philosophy behind immigration, because I proposed, of course, Hans Hermann Hoppe has his closed or at least controlled border argument, as well as some of the people over at Mises. Some of the people at Reason are border control libertarians. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think on the matter, and what do you think really is the goal of immigration in a free society?
Well, it's good that you brought up the Hans Hermann Hoppe position, because I tend to agree for the most part with it, actually.
Okay.
And for those who don't know, what is that?
Okay. It's that... even in an anarcho-capitalist society, people are presumably going to be living in clusters, cities, for example, mm-hmm, right? And some cities may decide voluntarily that they want to limit who or vet the type of people that get to live in the city. Whereas other cities can decide, no, we our borders are open to anybody. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a to each their own approach.
Right.
Yeah. Now, question to clarify, what if somebody is in the city who has private property and they want to invite in someone who the rest don't find appealing? Does that private property still reign in that instance? Or
so when that individual chose to live in that city, they would have to beforehand agree to abide by this particular policy, right?
Would that mean that they don't actually own the property, or it would be some sort of like, hey, if we own the or somebody else owns the electricity or the sewage, you know, some way of enforcing these voluntary arrangements? Because as we all know, it boils down to property.
Yeah, there would be a way of enforcing it. I wouldn't say that it would go so far as to take away that person's property or something along those lines, right?
Okay.
But, you know, every city would figure out a way to enforce it.
Okay, so anyways, continue.
So I want to establish, before we get into the nitty-gritty of this position and parsing out, let's say, both the arguments for and against in our society, I want to map out, perhaps if there is, and I would agree that there is, a proper anarcho-capitalist position on immigration. Now, no one would say that Hans Hermann Hoppe, and this is what Block said as well, is not an anarcho-capitalist. He's provided so much to the intellectual database of anarcho-capitalism and the nature of the free society that it's hard to say that he isn't that which most people would call him, an anarcho-capitalist. But now, I disagree with his position, and I was on the fence about this before I even spoke with Walter Block, and I really sympathize with a lot of what Hans Hermann Hoppe was saying. I ended up going the opposite direction, and I'll explain that in a minute. But are you meaning to say, and I want to establish this amongst all three of us, that in an anarcho-capitalist society where everyone owns the property in which they're living in, I own, mm-hmm, you know, my square where my house is, somebody owns the roads, et cetera, and we all are working in contractual agreement with one another. Mm-hmm. Now, in that situation, we would certainly have the ability to reject an individual from trespassing onto our property, Right. Now, if that person wasn't invited into our home, let's say, or into our business, we wouldn't have to serve them. We wouldn't have to have them come into our home. Like if somebody was unwelcome, you wouldn't be able to ride on the road. Let's say it was a criminal. You wouldn't be able to ride on a road if you get into accidents or if you're a murderer or something like that, that sort of thing. So we have the ability to reject people from private property.
Right.
However, in situations where we involved in, let's see, a contractual arrangements with a larger group of people, let's say a private city, for instance, and every single person that is living within that city says, we don't want Asians. So Jeff, right. You are not welcome in, the city of Danny Boy. Danny Boy hates Asians, ironically.
Yeah.
So you're not allowed in there. That is just and moral in an anarcho-capitalist society.
I do think so, yes.
Okay. Now,
it might not be what I prefer, but
right.
I do.
Right.
And do you think that they have a right to exist that way?
Okay. Now, Danny, do you agree with that as well?
Well, I mean, racism and any sort of bigoted prejudice is really irrational and stupid, but I still believe people have a right to their property. Mm. And if you don't wish to associate with somebody, I mean, like, because the opposite or the other side of the coin is to support trespassing or violation of property rights. So while some people may have irrational beliefs, I'm not going to say that they're obligated to serve me or accommodate me or accommodate anybody. So I don't know if I would, you know, there may be some moral, in the sense, like there may be unenforceable morals at play, but in terms of enforceability, yeah, I agree with Jeff. You know, as much as I may disagree with them and think they're losers and hate them, I'm not going to suggest that their property rights be violated.
Right.
And
I need to parse out these two things. What is legal may not be moral, and what is moral might not be legal, of course. Right. So you know, my preference that there is a universal morality, I cannot subjugate that sort of morality onto somebody else in an anarcho-capitalist society outside of the basic tenets of the non-aggression principle vis-a-vis property ownership, bodily ownership and property ownership. So, you know, if I own my territory and I don't let you to come in, it may actually be immoral that I'm not letting you in. Somebody might not think that that's moral, that I'm not letting, let's say, a black person into my business, but it can't be enforced that person come in. That's just unjust. So we're in agreement of that.
And the other thing is, why would they want to come in if they know that you're a racist? Right.
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 Okay. So it seems like we are in agreement, generally speaking. We don't need to construct this whole entire city as it is, you know, in order to move forward with this conversation. I just wanted to make sure we're all on the same page. Now, moving forward with that, since we are in agreement, we are in a world where not everybody owns the property in which they utilize. We have so-called public property, which is owned by everyone, which is conceptually for us as ANCAPs is silly. In an ANCAP society, that would simply not exist. Everybody would own land here and there and everywhere, and that which isn't owned would be and could be embroidered and therefore owned after that. But in a world where there's public land and there is a government which extorts taxes from people, and there are then immigrants that want to come into the property, public property, and come into our state, that is where the libertarians start to disagree. I want to talk a little bit about that. Jeff, you are pro-controlled borders. As it stands, in a world where there is a government, albeit it's an immoral government that extorts and uses coercive force against its own people and goes into wars and all that sort of thing. We all agree that the government is bad. Still, we think that you believe that the government should use its military force to keep certain people.
Well, there are two Milton Friedman quotes that I would like to bring up right now.
Mm-hmm.
One is that it's something along the lines of it's a big mistake to judge policies by their intentions rather than their results.
Okay.
Right. And the second one is that you can't have a welfare state and open borders. You can have a welfare state or open borders, but you can't have both.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So if we look at the countries you know, it's great when you can learn from your own mistakes, but it's even better when you can learn from the mistakes of others, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at countries that have done the open borders experiment, Germany and Sweden in particular have had especially disastrous effects, right? I think that one of the big problems is this goes back to the welfare state, is the reason why these European countries have been flooded with immigrants who don't particularly want to integrate and don't particularly want to become productive members of that society is because they've been incentivized by the welfare state, right? All the benefits that they get from fleeing their country and going to these countries. That's why they're flocking by the millions towards these places, right?
The fact of the matter is that we have a welfare state giving out free money to individuals that have not earned it. And since there is a break in the incentivization between work and capital and a redistribution of those who are born natively within the state's boundaries to those who may have not been born inside those boundaries, therefore, we should keep some people out. Now, who do you think that we should keep out?
Well, any welfare state has a limitation to how many people it can support, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're bringing people in, and if we're going to have a welfare state and we're going to bring people in, then we have to make sure that it doesn't become a economic disaster, right? So that's why countries should be selective about who they bring in.
Okay, so are you in favor of bringing in, let's say, high-skill workers or low-skill workers or a mixture of both? Or where do we draw the line? What should we be seeking in terms of our immigration program?
Right. Yeah, high-skill workers is certainly a good thing to bring in, right? People who want to be productive members of society. Now, each country can kind of determine for themselves what kind of people they want to bring in and what determines who is going to be a productive member of society, right?
I hear usually three different arguments for, let's say, control borders. It's the economical, typically the criminal aspect, and then there's the cultural incompatibility. Those are the three ones I hear. Oh, and I also hear there's the moral one, and that kind of plays a part into all three of those. Let's say, you know, certain people define morals as certain different things. So let's say you're bringing a bunch of people that are incongruent culturally with Christianity. And so they say we shouldn't bring these sorts of people. And that actually falls in the moral as well as the cultural. But sometimes it's not always the case. So those are usually the ones that I hear. Now, you're making principally an economical argument. And
kind of all three in a way, I guess.
Okay. So you also...
Well, I haven't really brought up the cultural thing. But right.
Let me address... I'd like to address, I suppose, the reason why I am a proponent of open borders. And when
in the world right now.
The world right now. I see it very problematic to be a proponent of, let's say, the opening of or the legality of, let's say, drugs, or let's say the legality of owning any single firearm that you want, or the legality of, let's say, living with or marrying whomever you want, even though I believe that marriage really shouldn't be up to the government anyways, even though, you know, that seems to be regulated with the incentive of taxes. It's very strange to be fighting for the legality of these sorts of things. Box off the consistent argument for the allowability of people being able to move back and forth from one location to the other. So if an individual wanted to, I mean, the whole idea comes into play that we have one person that's trying to get to America, okay? And we have borders, and these borders are arbitrary. They are arbitrary. They might be due to treaties, geographical features. They might have been private property at one point. They might be a variety of things. States have, you know, some very weird reasons why these borders exist.
But so, I would argue that they're not necessarily completely arbitrary because of that then, right? Because there is a historical reason why they exist in the way they do right now.
Well, and perhaps, but those reasons aren't consistent across the board due to private ownership.
Right.
You know, the fact that a mountain might prevent someone you know, for moving from one place to another might be a practical reason why you would create a border, but it is, and therefore it might not be arbitrary, but that same mountain might actually be valuable to another person, and therefore they would want to own that land, but they can't because the government might own it. So there's an incongruence when it comes to the sorts of borders that occur. So we have an institution called the government that has claimed ownership immorally of certain, or and also created all these sorts of arbitrary, and we are willing to enforce those particular arbitrary boundaries, which we know are enforced through immoral coercion, through our own, the products of the fruits of our own labor. But we don't want that same government to enforce, let's say, the drug war. So we're basically using the government as a tool, and we aren't being very pure, nor are we being, I don't want to use the word consistency.
Consistency is the right word, though,
yeah,
right?
I guess it is. Yeah. We're willing to make an exception to the immorality of the government's existence because of the fact they have borders that we would like them to enforce. And
So let me go into how I reconcile this. Mm-hmm. Right. I see it as it's a necessity for now. Right now, we can't just immediately deregulate or get rid of the state completely and have them not regulate anything. I think it's a process, right? Mm-hmm. So for the time being, something like borders, we still need the state for that. Something like military, for example, we still need the state for that, right? Over time, as our societies get freer and freer, then private cities may be able to enforce their own borders, right? And then we would no longer need the federal government to do that.
So the aegis of the government is only useful insofar as, or it should exist insofar as it is useful.
Mm-hmm.
All right. See, I find that to be troubling because we then can simply use the government as a tool to harm our enemies. And this is precisely what political parties are doing right now. And it doesn't make us any better, either morally or in a just sense of the good society. It doesn't make us any better off or any more morally sound than, let's say, the Republican that says that they're open, they're free trade and are interested in free trade mostly, but a little bit of tariffs here and there to make sure that the automotive industry is okay. And we don't.
But don't you see that as a step towards progress? If the Republican says, you know, I love free trade except for this, this, and this, but then maybe the next Republican who gets elected takes one of those tariffs away because he's following in the same line of thinking as the previous one, right? Until they slowly get rid of all the tariffs.
I'm of the mind that governments don't shrink, so perhaps that we might be philosophically at odds there. I haven't ever seen a government shrink without simply collapsing.
Right, that's fair.
So I don't really see realistically the government just acquiescing all of the power that it has, even if it's the people's desire. It just continues to grow and grow and grow. So the immigration arm of the government is just one very, very powerful aspect of this sort of thing. And it has been weaponized by particular parties for, let's say, racism or, I mean, there are some legitimate concerns that people have. Cultural incompatibility for some specific cultures, I agree. Let's say I don't think that Islam is particularly liberal. And I mean liberal in the sense of the classical liberal, egalitarian and free market and all that sort of thing. It clearly prescribes a sort of theocratic way of living. But that being said, I find it very hard to justify keeping those sorts of people out if I'm going to be philosophically consistent. And if I want anybody to take me seriously when it comes to everything else that I say that should be legal and free.
But if you look at what has happened to Sweden.
Right. The rape capital of the world.
Rape capital of the world.
Yeah.
And what like, for example, cities like Molenbeek in Brussels. And the Calais jungle in Paris, right? You know, that's what people are afraid of, right? That's why people are so adamant against open borders.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that these things. I mean, these things clearly happen, and they happen due to at its core, a welfare state, which I think is what we should be attacking. I think that that needs to be the focus of our attack, that we remain philosophically consistent and we can continue to attack the welfare state for what it is, just simply handing out money and breaking the connection between work and capital.
Mm-hmm. Could I chime in, gentlemen?
Yeah, no, go ahead. It's sure. A three-way here.
So, this is a bit frustrating because you're trying to deal with a ridiculous contraption that makes no sense. So I like the analogy that government has created a minefield and we're all like standing amongst all these bombs. And then government says, see, we can't have freedom because if you do, at the moment you do, you'll be blown up. It's like, no, we just shouldn't coerce people and put them. We shouldn't place bombs underneath people's feet. You get the idea. If we're trying to, it's impossible to have philosophical purity when we are neck deep in the mechanism of government, where it has perverted all of the natural functions of society, like social ostracism, like voluntary charity, et cetera. So this is why I hate getting down in the weeds and saying, well, I'm for open borders, but, you know, given the current circumstances, I think we need closed borders because of cultural incompatibility. It's like, yeah, of course, freedom is, if you want freedom, you need to have all the way freedom. You can't have freedom amongst, you know, all of these other mechanisms which would actually backfire. So I think it's definitely true to Jeff's point that you can't have open borders and a welfare state. But this is why we should argue for all the way freedom, and particularly because of the people who are watching us and listening to us. It's going to get very confusing and very polarized quickly if we don't make our arguments very clear. We're shooting ourselves in the foot if we align ourselves with the alt-right or the other side of things when we say, well, we can't let them in because of cultural incompatibility. Like that argument, it has some aspects which are absolutely contradictory to the message of freedom. I personally, I don't like to rearrange the chairs on the deck of the Titanic as it's sinking. So the way I would address these things is to say, yeah, of course, you know, we're going to have problems if we just open the floodgates right now. So that's not an argument for closed borders. It's an argument for all the way freedom, where we can let people in to allow free movement and private property. But we also have to allow people to freely have voluntary associations. So you aren't forced to serve people or to commingle with people who you don't agree with or people who want to kill you. You aren't forced to fund their lifestyle, et cetera. So this is a golden opportunity for us to advocate for all the way freedom and to present a clear and cogent and wildly practical way of organizing society instead of trying to parse out, well, you know, yes, but like it kills me when I hear the argument, yes, but, you know, it's like, we're not here to solve every conceivable scenario imaginable. The government, yeah, there are some situations you can't cleanly fix. You got to throw the whole thing out and start over. And we don't need to, we're not called to fix the mess that has been accumulated for hundreds of years of government interference in society. We're here to offer a real life solution. And if people want that, they need to take the whole pill, not, you know, pick and choose. And sorry for the rant.
No, that was great. But actually, there is still some concern that I have regarding, let's put this hypothetical situation. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's say we have a small village of ANCAPs, right? And we have our own little, you know, voluntary society, right? And then, but we live on a particularly desirable piece of land. Let's say there's a beautiful mountains and great lakes there, right?
Yeah.
And in the next village over, there's a village of communists. And they're jealous of our land, right? So they decide, hey, these guys have open borders. All we really need to do is start moving there, and then we can take over their society, right? Mm-hmm. So we, as the ANCAPs who finally have our perfect society, now have to deal with this problem. How would you guys propose that we deal with the influx of communists?
If they have, are these individuals saying that they want to come in and take over the land, or they would, they want to vote us out, or they want to use force in order to attack us?
They would come. Well, they would come. They would immigrate to our land first.
So okay. They would immigrate and then change the culture.
Eventually they would. Oh yeah. Change the culture. Outnumber us, change the culture, install their own government kind of thing.
Well, right. if we had a suspicion that that was what was going to happen, there is no reason why you can't keep them out. But the idea is that the ANCAPs own their own land. The government we're using as a useful tool. We know that the weapon is illegitimate. The existence of the weapon is illegitimate. That the borders that they're trying to get into are arbitrary. Nobody really owns them. We don't have any delineation of that. So we can't justifiably defend against these sorts of people that are coming in. But we can in an ANCAP society where we, if everybody says, okay, yeah, these people, these are definitely communists. They have ill intentions. We don't have to let them in because we own our own property. We can all say, you don't get to come in. If one person says, okay, you can come in and live at my home. Okay, well then they can. That person is more than welcome to come in there. If they want to host a whole entire village in their own home, then so be it. But you would wonder if why a bunch of freedom loving individuals would then host a bunch of individuals that clearly want to take away that freedom within that village. I mean, that would just be a breakdown of that same, you know, moral and legal system, that normative system that they have adopted.
Well, it could be that some of them are being offered a, you know, generous sum of money, right, from a backer like George Soros, for example, right?
It is, sorry to interrupt, Mike.
Yeah, go ahead.
We can come up with any number of like really far out circumstances. Like what if we had an island of ANCAPistan and then the entirety of the world were statist and they wanted to take you over? What do you do? It's like, yeah, you might be doomed. We can't offer a ironclad guarantee no matter what. But I think, you know, that's why we are advocating for a, you know, worldwide, global, universal philosophical change. And, you know, it's definitely possible to come up with hypotheticals that could potentially, you know, work out in the negative. But I don't think it is useful to try to derive principles backwards. Like, well, what if this? Well, what if that? We could simply say like, well, you know, if we are presented with such an exceptionally rare circumstance, then, you know, maybe we violate the principles, but at least we recognize that it is a violation of these principles, and principles were made to account for the vast majority of circumstances. I mean, we're not trying to be legalistic here because that principles don't exist as their own God to be worshipped. They exist to serve us. So, you know, if you're about to be nuked and you have to kill one innocent person, you know, okay, do it. But, you know, generally speaking, if you have a free society and you have communists coming in, I can think of a million and one ways personally that we could avert that disaster. Like as soon as they start to try to take your land or your labor or anything of that, as soon as they commit any aggression, you respond in kind, you use force, you shoot them, you kill them, whatever you know, the proportional response is. But that's all I have to say. Okay. Off the soapbox for me.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, no, yeah. Because I think, like, you have to acknowledge that this is what a lot of people do when they analyze various political philosophies. They come up with scenarios, right?
Yeah. They want a guarantee. And, you know, who's to say, like, if they're espousing a minimal state, you can come back and play that game. You say, well, what if your state gets infiltrated by communists or fascists, and then all of a sudden it grows into an oligarchy, and then the whole world gets nuked or environmental destruction? It's like anybody can come up with a what if scenario. But the question is this soccer ball going to be blown up to the top of Mount Everest through the happenstance of winds and hurricanes? You know, you got to go with what's likely, not what's possible. You know what I mean?
The normative statements that we are laying down, they have to be able to address most practical circumstances. Like if, for instance, the rules that we create don't even permit us to, let's say, you know, trade with one another, they're not very good rules. Or let's say if they prevent half of the activities that we can do, or let's say if they're positivistic and they encumber a certain group of individuals in order to benefit another group. You know, these sorts of things are important. And bringing up, let's say, an example like what Jeff said, which I think is a very adroit way to demonstrate how an ANCAP society would work or could work, because it would have enemies and it would have aggressors. These are things that need to be discussed, and I think this is a proper forum to do so. That is a pretty reasonable expectation that there are criminals and there might be large bodies of criminals with cultural differences than us that need to be taken care of, or at least need to be philosophically dealt with. I don't think that this is far and away inappropriate to discuss, you know, an example like Jeff might be saying. I think that the rules that exist, the sorts of property ownership and bodily ownership, give us a pretty clear-cut reason as to why we can deny people that might be culturally incompatible when all of the territory in a given land is owned. So,
yeah, well, you could definitely respond to a credible threat of force, by the way. Like if ISIS is threatening to come into your town and kill you, like you can send a missile over there because that's a threat. That's coercion.
Right. But these people are coming with the interest of infiltrating the society and doing it democratically or whatever it is, but doing it through culture. And that's much different. And still, you have the justification to deny people simply because you don't think that they're culturally compatible because of your preferences. And if everyone says that, then that's the case. If, let's say, only a couple people want to let them in, then they can let them in. And then guess what? You don't do business with those people, and then they leave. So the majority of the individuals within ANCAPistan, let's say, we don't want to do business with these people that are culturally incompatible. Maybe that sounds a little harsh, but guess what? That's everything within their rights to do so. That's the voluntary exchange of goods. So there you go.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty satisfactory answer, I think. One of the better arguments I've heard.
Okay, so we've been talking about immigration for a while, and this is fantastic because this is one of the big reasons why I wanted to bring you on to here. But I want to talk briefly, and we might actually have to bring you on again to talk further about this, but I want to touch upon the nationalism discussion, and we don't have too long to do it, but you made the statement that I thought was very interesting, and I'm not sure whether you hold this belief now. Maybe you changed your mind, but you made the proposition that perhaps nationalism is not quite as dangerous as what's going on within the social justice movement, within what are called progressives, maybe not liberals. Old-fashioned liberals have definitely made themselves well aware that they are not part of the progressive movement. Yeah. And, you know, those professors that call themselves liberal now are usually progressives, not liberals. Yeah. And those ones that are now that used to call themselves liberals now don't even know what to call themselves. But you have said that you think that perhaps nationalism is more dangerous than that sort of thing. And I want to hear whether that's still the case.
Less dangerous.
Less dangerous.
You said dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the term globalism kind of has a few different meanings, right?
Yes.
But the type of globalism that I'm talking about is step is a movement towards one world government, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I've had arguments with progressives where I've asked them, would you be in favor of a one world government, right? This was an argument over Brexit, right, where I was talking about national sovereignty. And some of them have said, yes, I would be in favor if that government was just. And I would say, like, that is a pretty big if, isn't it? If that's everybody thinks that as long as we get the right people, you know, as long as the right people put on the ring, then it won't corrupt them, right?
Mm.
Yeah. So that's why I say nationalism is the decentralization of globalism, right? It's a step in the right direction, right?
Yeah, it does seem to be interested in a division based off of it's ethnocentric necessarily. Yeah. And so therefore it believes that certain races are and ethnicities are like oil and water, and therefore they cannot be compatible with one another. So therefore they shouldn't be forced through some type of government. So traditionally nationalists will vote for racial homogeneity, and therefore they are collectivists in their own right. And I'm not sure that I want to make sure that that I have this right. I mean, you don't think that nationalism is a great thing, but you don't think it's as good, as bad, progressivism.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I don't think nationalism necessarily has to be ethnocentric. I mean, it in a lot of countries in the world right now, yes, probably it is. But I think over time, as, you know, more and more countries trade with each other and there's more and more immigration and there's more and more cultural exchange, I think that can change.
So when you say that nationalism doesn't have to be ethnocentric, give me an example of a, let's say in this current situation, in our current world, give me a situation where we can be nationalistic, but not ethnocentric.
Canada, I guess, kind of, you know, we don't have much of a national identity, but, you know, a lot of Canadians are fairly proud to be Canadian, right? They still love their country.
So you're saying that Canadians have a collective identity?
Yeah.
And that isn't really...
It's not ethnocentric.
Okay. Do you think that nationalism, let's say, I mean, I'm not sure whether nationalism is present a whole lot in Canada outside of the pride to be Canadian, whether mm-hmm. there's a sort of backlash against that's going on in Canada. But as we see it in, let's say, academia, and also we're seeing as a backlash against the alt-right, which then was a backlash against the alt-right, was a reaction against progressivism. So now we have a bunch of people trying to differentiate themselves, let's say on the right, from the alt-right and saying, you know, these are the globalists and these are the nationalists. On the alt-right are saying down with the Zionists, and some of the Zionists are on the right, and it's all just a, you know, a whole entire mess. We're seeing a lot of divisions of that sort of thing. I don't think that's happening in Canada.
Not so much, no.
You don't really have a phenomenon like the alt-right that's going on there.
Not really among, you know, like, I hate to use the term normies, but, you know, a lot of people on the internet use this term.
What is that?
But yeah, it's the people who aren't plugged in, right? People who are unaware of the culture war, pretty much, right? They're normal people who live normal everyday lives, right?
I've never even heard of that.
Most Canadians are normies, I think. A lot of Canadians are largely unaware that there's a culture war going on.
So the tendency of nationalism to exist within, let's say, any particular very homogenous civilization, like Japanese are notoriously... one person might use the word xenophobic. I might actually use the word xenophobic. I mean, they're like 98-97% Japanese. They do not allow a lot of immigration.
Japan is pretty much alt-right.
Right? Yeah, kind of. And they are ethnocentrically alt-right, or I should say ethnocentrically nationalistic. But don't you think that nationalism ends up becoming a homogeneous culture after a long period of time, that basically what happens to a given region, because they continue to breed and they create homogeneity, and then after a while they're proud of their own region and their accomplishments and that sort of thing, so they attribute those accomplishments then to the fact that, you know, they're all white, or they're all Asian, or they're all whatever color it might be, that they have suddenly become homogeneous. I mean, that is ultimately how nationalism has come about, simply because people are born of a given region and they attribute their accomplishments to, very crudely and erroneously, to their own ethnicity. Like, you know, given time in America, either people think it might go one way or another, that we all breed with each other, that all the in-groups are somehow destroyed, and everyone, you know, blacks breed with Asians, who breed with, you know, Latinos, and we, there's just like one race. And then other people think that people have in-group preferences, they'll stay with their in-group preferences, they'll continue to breed with their own in-group preferences, and we'll just stay not so much a melting pot as it's been called, but I've heard, what was it, like a pizza or something like that, where all the ingredients like basically stay within their own zones. They kind of work with one another and all that, but some regions, some smaller regions, have just bred with one another and created a new, you know, just a new people, like in America, the Cajuns and the Creoles. The Creole are the descendants of some of the black slaves. They're kind of bunched into them, and they're also the city dwellers. The Cajuns are like the backwater hicks, and mm-hmm. they're the descendants of the French colonials, and they created their own people. So if you take that in a regional aspect right there, let's say just Louisiana was its own thing, that's what happened. So the Cajuns have a certain amount of ethnocentric pride of being what they are. If they were their own state, they have that sort of collectivist ethnocentric mindset, and they attribute a lot of their own accomplishments to them being that skin color, which I think is erroneous in what we see a lot with the alt-right.
How do you differentiate between pride in pride in your race versus pride in your culture? Because the two are kind of like very closely linked together, right? So if I say Chinese people have accomplished a lot, it's not necessarily because, but the color of our skin, but it's more, it has to do with our culture and our collective beliefs too, right? Our values.
Yeah. I mean, I always say that a peoples don't do something, individuals do things. Individuals do things. They do things in cooperation with one another, and they each contribute their own ingredient to whatever it is that they are doing. So it's impossible for, let's say, the white people to do something, even though some people that happen to have the skin color white or are of European descent, whatever that might be, have done this sort of thing. Culture is really difficult, yes, to separate from, let's say, a region, because people of a region end up creating this particular culture, and everyone contributes a little bit to that sort of culture, and the culture grows almost without the people in which it embodies. But you can't have culture without people. You know, if the people don't exist, then there's nothing for the culture to be embodied within. And therefore, it's pretty much useless. Like, if everyone was wiped out, then what good is culture? It's just gone. Mm-hmm. I think that generally speaking, I agree with you that nationalism is less problematic to liberty if it is not ethnocentric. But I mm-hmm. think nationalism ends up becoming ethnocentric. And we can mm-hmm. see that in some of the outgrowths. I don't mean to say that the alt-right is this huge movement. And it really isn't as big as people think. Mm-hmm. But I think that people have in-group preferences, and we see that a lot in America. In a place where there's so many different people, we still see in-group preferences, and we still see people attributing the successes of America not to the fact that we have freedom and liberty and that we have a culture, to the fact that that we are a member of a European descent.
Right.
And that's the problem. It just seems like nationalism, mm-hmm. the nationalistic mindset leads towards that. While the progressive philosophy is inherently corrupt, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I pretty much agree with you on that.
Yeah. Danny, what do you think about that?
Well, just a shout out to, I don't know, the people like me in the audience who are starting to get distracted and look at the stained glass during the church service. Like, I hate this shit so much. Like, nationalism versus progressivism. They're all just one form of bullshit collectivism or another. Mm-hmm. And some are, a little bit more or less irrational than the other. I mean, this is why we need clear, concise philosophy. People, what matters are individuals. If you didn't do it, you don't get to brag about it. Racist collectivism is batshit crazy. And cultural collectivism is a little better, but still, taking credit for stuff that you didn't do or had very, very little contribution for. So, personally, I really like to cut to the chase. I just get so exhausted with all of these. You could call me like a purist, maybe, but I'm not interested in unraveling the mess that's been created and trying to solve every Rubik's Cube that the government has created for us. Like, and I think it goes a long way to just cut to the chase so that, the people, the onlookers, they realize that we are principled. I'm not saying that you guys are, it's not a useful discussion that you're having, but my personal preference, who was it? Thoreau. For every 1,000 that are hacking at the branches of tyranny, there's one striking the root. Mm-hmm. And, that is what got me into the movement, is the pure philosophical consistency. I don't think anybody really gives a shit at the end of the day about all of the intricacies of nationalism and the alt-right. It's like, that gets boring after a while, We're all ultimately, it's about human individual freedom. I don't mean to poo-poo this, you know, brilliant intellectual conversation you guys are having, but it also grates on me a little.
Well, the thing about hacking at the root is that, you know, the often the criticism of purists is that you're not being pragmatic, right? I mean, you can hack at the root, but there's all these branches, like, you know, in our face right now, right? So sometimes we got to hack at the branches too.
Yeah, definitely. It's a long versus short term, and sometimes you have to save yourself in the moment, right? But
yeah, I think. Go ahead, Danny. Sorry.
I was just gonna say, you know, we're all on the same page. It's just a matter of tactics. You know, do we cut off our arm to save our neck? You know, maybe, maybe not. It's short term versus long term stuff.
Yeah,
we know what we need to support. Often we don't know what we should reject, and that's why I say, do we reject the sort of, let's say, as Jeff says, the non-ethnocentric nationalism? Is it something that, you know, personally, it doesn't do a whole lot for me, but when I talk to people, is this something that really fits into the worldview that I'm trying to push? And how do I go about correcting this sort of thing? So I have to be very precise with my philosophy, and I want to be able to communicate what I believe to other people, because there's a wide variety of shapes and sizes that might fit into an anarcho-capitalist society. People can do whatever they want outside of, you know, those fundamental things that we have set forth. So sometimes it might not violate those things, but it might not be good for the society. And I think that I can do both, propel liberty forward and also tell people you should probably steer away from this, 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 and this. Even though I can't justifiably prevent them from doing that, I can say, here, try this on for size.
You guys are more patient than me. I just, I don't have the patience for it, but good for you. I give you a lot of credit for that.
Yes. So, Jeff, we have done this with a couple of our guests where we just go way, way over. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. But, you know, I think both of us really enjoyed the conversation that we had with you. And we didn't even get to talk a little bit more about the model minority. And we didn't get to talk about Canadian politics all that much. And I wanted to get a little bit more deep into some of this other stuff. But rest assured to our listeners who felt that they were slighted, and you, Jeff, I definitely want to have you on. I know Danny probably feels the same, to talk a little bit more about this stuff. We will do so. It's just our time is running out. So I wanted to give the listeners an idea of where they can reach you and learn more about you and some of your thoughts, because I know that you blog and you're also active on social media. So where should we send listeners to?
Two places. First, my Facebook page, The Asian Capitalist. It's facebook.com/TheAsianCapitalist.
Okay.
Or Asian Capitalist. I don't remember if there's a D in there.
We'll put it in the show notes so you can send that to me.
And my YouTube channel is also called The Asian Capitalist. Actually, it's The Asian Capitalist, plural.
Oh, okay. That's, very good.
Yeah. If you happen to stop by there and you see that I don't have a lot of followers, don't worry. That's actually my page. It's a work in progress, like I said, right?
No worries. We were very happy to have you on, and you know, 1,000 followers, 10,000, it doesn't matter. As long as we have a good conversation and the listeners get a lot out of it, that's really what we're doing it for. And
hopefully they did.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have you on soon enough. Remember, guys, this is Flagship Freedom, the podcast that places you on the front line in the war of ideas. Till the next battle. See you later.
Bye-bye.
And that one desire is you. And I know nobody else ain't gonna do.